Should we start? Good.
Okay.
Good. Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you. I first want to just begin by thanking Rabbi Rebach and Adas Torah for opening their home for this shiur. And the series we've been moving it all over, and I try to match as best as possible the different shiur with the location. But some shiur, don't match exactly. And but nonetheless, because it's a history of LA, I thought it particularly should move in different places. And I just want to let Rabbi Rebach know that when we get to, I think, Shir 11 or 12, we're going to get into the pivotal role that Adas Torah plays in the history and development of Los Angeles. It's a very unique role.
What?
Well, that's maybe a little bit there, but now that you mention it, though. No, but it really does. It's really, in a significant way, it's Adas Torah is paving a very new road here in Los Angeles. And it will be mentioned in the appropriate time, God willing. Okay, just to give a backdrop, for those who were here at the last one, we talked about the history of the Persian community, the Iranian community, Orthodox Iranian community here in Los Angeles. That we springboarded from the history of Beth Jacob. Now, we need to move backwards, because the history of the Iranian community begins in 1979. Our story goes back to the 50s. So, because we're roaming, it's not exactly a perfectly lateral history, but we'll organize it at the end to make sure it's clear. But I want to go back to the point in time where we left a couple classes ago, where we spoke about the development of Boyle Heights. After leaving Boyle Heights, really the godfather, so to speak, of the Jewish community, the Frum community, was Rav Asher Zilberstein. Rav Asher Zilberstein was trained in the great yeshivas, was loved by, we saw how he was welcomed to Israel by the chief rabbi. They made a party just for him. And if you were a school, if you were an establishment in Los Angeles, for you to exist, you had to in some way connect to his address, to Rabbi Zilberstein's address. Because of that, when you align yourself, when a community is built by one person, so to speak, and we saw the many different great figures that were here, when the community is built by one person, what happens is, at some point there's going to be a movement that says we want something different. And we talked about the development of Hillel. We talked about the development. We had to skip over the Yavna class. We'll get back to that. Hillel and Yavna. Does a city need a gadol to thrive and survive? That's the question. Does a city need a gadol? Now, how do you define gadol? No one will have a good definition for the phrase gadol or the term gadol. But for our purposes, it's somebody larger than life whose Torah is everything to them, who is a living embodiment of the Torah. There were great people that have been here before the 1950s, and I've mentioned their names, people who were walking Svarim shelves. We talked about Rav Tzirlin, who was a library, encyclopedic library, a student of the Rugachever. We spoke about those people. Besides just living and breathing Torah, your life needs to be dedicated to the mass impact and reach of Torah itself. You need to be able to teach Torah in a way that affects the masses. And in that sense, Los Angeles has not had a gadol yet. They haven't had a gadol. So the question is, does a city need a gadol to thrive? And I think the answer is, if you look at LA, they were missing something going into the 1950s. The day schools are getting revved up. Yes, the high schools are a bit lacking at this point, and it's still a fledgling movement. The shuls are thriving. The communities moved away from Boyle Heights and now developing new communities. But we really, truly are missing a gadol. A great gadol was here in L.A. for a very short time, and most people in L.A., if you ask them, don't even realize it. And he's not the subject of my talk tonight, but he was here. His name is Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. Right now, arguably the biggest gadol, one of the biggest gadolim in America, on the American scene. Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky was a Rebbe in a yeshiva here in Los Angeles. I'm going to let you know how he got here in the first place, but you're going to have, for a brief moment in time, a confluence of gedolim in one spot. The story begins with one of the greatest gedolim in the last 200 years, and that gadol is Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, the author of the great Kobetz Mamarim, which is on Yevamos, and you have the Kobetz Shiurim, which two volumes beautifully goes through many great sugyas, classic, and his essays on the Yemos HaMashiach, the end of time, and the Jewish Hashkafa is a classic as well. These Svarim of Rav Elchanan Wasserman are a staple of any major yeshiva. I'm not going to ask if they're here on the shelf. My guess is they're somewhere in the room. They're in the room. They're in the room. I'm not going to ask. They're in the room. You can't have a yeshiva without Rav Elchanan Wasserman's svarim in the base medrash somewhere. Rav Elchanan Wasserman's oldest son was Rav Simcha Wasserman. He is the oldest son who will be left after the Shoah. I'm going to go through the family in a moment. Rav Simcha Wasserman, his son, helped build a community in Strasbourg, France. Right in Strasbourg, he helped build the community there for a very short time. After that, what you have is the Shoah. If you want to know Rav Elchanan Wasserman's story in the Shoah and what happened, you just need to read the opening remarks at the beginning of his Sefer Kobetz Yoram. You see the painful letter that he wrote when he knew the end was coming. It's the writing of someone who knows that the end is near, but his life is dedicated kulo to Hashem, with the words literally Shema Yisrael on his lips. That's how his life ended, Rav Elchanan Wasserman. His son, Rav Simcha Wasserman, normally I would say anybody who had lost so much with such trauma, the normal reaction you would think is that you're finished, you pack up, and you live your life quietly and try to make the most of it that you can in simplicity. Rav Simcha Wasserman was not resolved to live that kind of life. Why? He himself said the following. He says, Noach should have drowned himself in any rebuilding. Noach should have given up. And says Rav Simcha Wasserman, to an extent, he did. To an extent, when he went for that drink, when he went to build the vines, when he went to plant grapes, after he got up the ark, Noach, in a sense, was beginning to relinquish. But says Rav Simcha Wasserman, but he still went on and built a family and built a life. And he still went on and offered korbanos to Hashem. Says Rav Simcha Wasserman, there's no time to stop after everything that's happened. Rav Simcha Wasserman quotes the Ber Agola to Choshen Mishpat that says that Gezel Akum, stealing from a non-Jew, is usser. So he says as follows, Rav Simcha Wasserman, do you know what the author of the Ber Agola, Rav Moshe Rifkus, do you know what he suffered through? His whole family was massacred by non-Jews. Yet he still paskened that stealing from a non-Jew is usser. Says Rav Simcha Wasserman, how could you paskin that way? Rav Simcha Wasserman says, because truth is truth. Truth is truth. And MS needs to be continued, no matter what your feelings are. Now, he did not believe that the survivors needed to repress their feelings. On the contrary, Rav Simcha Wasserman wrote, he said, that every year I allocate time to feel the pain and suffering of what my family had gone through, of what the Jews had gone through. We call it the 3 weeks. We call it Av. We call it Tisha B'Av. But for the rest of the year, I have to get busy building. I have to get busy making a life for Jews around the world. I cannot stop. I cannot stop. By the way, we have to be careful that this is not a eulogy. I'll tell you why. Rav Simcha Wasserman left a letter saying, right, a tzava, that I only want to be eulogized if my wife is still here. What a beautiful idea. And tells you a lot about the relationship we're going to learn a little between the Rebbetzin and Rav Simcha Wasserman. He didn't want the covet. He didn't want us gathering together in Adas Torah and perhaps going on and on and on and elaborating about the life of Rav Simcha Wasserman. But he knew that his wife would want everyone to hear. And if his wife was still around, then I want all the hespedim in the world. If she's no longer around, I don't want any hespedim. How did Rav Simcha Wasserman become Rav Simcha Wasserman? What formed the identity of Rav Simcha Wasserman? He was an emissary for his father. His father sent him to take his shilas, to take his questions around to all the different gedolim of the time. Because of that, it meant that he was able to drink from a wide array of gedolim that he would travel to, which was an opportunity many did not have. You understand? People were either sending their correspondences to gedolim, or they were learning in a yeshiva. Rav Simcha Wasserman was the shaliach for his father, which meant he literally spent time with the greatest gedolim of pre-war Europe. His father took him to the man he considered his Rebbe. Who was Rav Elchanan Wasserman's Rebbe? It's the Chafetz Chaim. Rav Elchanan Wasserman took Rav Simcha Wasserman as a kid to go see the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim walked into Rav Simcha Wasserman walked into the room, right? And as the story goes, he saw a tall man, an elegant looking man, long beard at the back of the room. And Rav Simcha Wasserman says, wow, what an honor to see this amazing tzaddik in my lifetime. He said this as a young kid. His father says that's not the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim is the simple-looking Jew, the little one, sitting there in the corner, unassuming. And that had a lasting impact on Rav Simcha Wasserman. Why? He always kept up the persona of the Chafetz Chaim. And that was, by the way, part of the struggle for Rav Simcha Wasserman here in California. To know that he was a gadol while he was here was not apparent to everyone. Why? Because he carried himself like the Chafetz Chaim. He carried himself in an unassuming way. When you would sit in the Beis Medrash, the frock was off, the hat wasn't on, he would sit laid back. If you saw him in the street, you would see a pipe coming out of Rav Simcha Wasserman's mouth. He lived very much like the way the derech of the Chafetz Chaim, which was simplicity. There's nothing to show publicly. My kavod comes from those, if they know me, then they want to give me kavod. I have nothing to prove to anybody else. He spent 4 years in the great Navordak Yeshiva. That's where, when we talk about Musar, there is no place that you're going to get a stronger infusion of Musar than the Navordak Yeshiva. And he got it from the great altar of Yosef Yozel Hurwitz, the great altar of Navordak. Taught Musar, the concepts of Torah Lishma, learning Torah for Torah's sake, not because you need it for X, Y, and Z. That's pure Torah Lishma, just to enjoy that. Well, enjoy the Torah's Machlok, what's Torah Lishma, but just to for the purpose of Torah itself. He would end up marrying the daughter of the Av Beis Din of Navordak, who was Rav Meir Abovitz. The daughter's name was Feige Rachel Abovitz. In their lifetime, they wouldn't have any children. Rav Simcha Wasserman always told his wife when she felt terrible, when she thought maybe we didn't know who it was, whose fault, we'll never know, but she always felt terrible. And Rav Simcha Wasserman said, "Don't worry. The students here in Los Angeles, they're my children. They're our children here in L.A. He became a chavrusa with the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Elia Meir Bloch. He spent time studying under the great Rav Shimon Shkup. After he got married, he learned by the great Gon, the Slutsker Gon, who's Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Do you understand? These people that we only hear about when we buy the Art Scroll Haggadah that has all of them in it, collected in one book. He spent time by all of them. Quality time by each one of the Gedolim. You don't hear that from other great Gedolim. Almost all Gedolim have spent time by one or two great Gedolim. What made Rav Simcha Wasserman so colorful and so unique among the many life experiences was that he spent time by all the Gedolim of Eastern Europe. He spent time by all of them. He got smicha at the age of 29. That smicha at the age of 29 by Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer himself. He was captured eventually by the Russians. He was forced into slave labor. Every opportunity Rav Simcha Wasserman saw in his life as another golden opportunity. And Rav Simcha Wasserman said, "I learned something in the slave labor camps that would impact the way that I do my chinuch, in the way that I am mechanech, in the way that I educate. I saw the power of memory, of why I needed to memorize the content, memorize the information. A Jew doesn't know when they're going to have thousands of svarim on hand, or an iPhone where they can quickly go to HebrewBooks.org and look up any sefer in the world. You don't know what you're going to be around at any point in time. A Jew should have the Torah always on their lips, the Gemara always on their lips." After the camps were finished, Rav Simcha Wasserman said, "Any sefer that I'm going to begin learning, any shir that I'm going to give, I'm going to memorize it." And he was dedicated to memorizing his Torah. Therefore, walking here in the streets of LA, many of the streets that we walk ourselves, was someone who was walking with Kol HaTorah Kula as part of who they were. Rav Simcha Wasserman is a beautiful idea. I'm going to share with you Divrei Torah that I've heard from speaking to people that were in his shir, that were in his shirim, that were in his yeshiva. People that knew him when he went back to Israel to start a yeshiva. He says the following: "No man is an island. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created all of us as social beings. That means we need each other. And what does that mean? If God made a tailor, he made a tailor in such a way that the tailor is going to need the person who manufactures the fabrics for the tailor. God created the world in such a way that the tailor needs the people who can buy the material. God created the world in such a way the tailor will have shelves where to put his material on so that he could sell it. We all need each other. We all are intertwined, and our histories and our lives are woven together, as we're seeing from this history of Los Angeles. So many of the stories overlap. Who would have thought that the Persians, Iranian community, when struggling under what's going to happen with the Shah switching over to Khomeini, Would they ever have thought in a million years that a Rabbi Maurice Lamin, Ashkenaz of an Ashkenaz modern Orthodox rabbis in LA, is going to play any role in their survival or their thriving here in Los Angeles? Everyone's story is enmeshed here in Los Angeles in some way. Rav Simcha Wasserman said, the tailor needs everyone else. Why is a gambler puzzled from testifying according to the Mishnayos? Why is he no good? Says Rav Simcha Wasserman, he's no good to testify because for the gambler, everything's about him. It's not about producing for somebody else. It's about what can I get out of this? He's not being productive. There's no production. And here comes the essence of Rav Simcha Wasserman's hashkafa. Torah learning is the epitome of production. That's a new hashkafa for Los Angeles. You have to understand this. That hashkafa is relatively new to Los Angeles, the concept that when you are learning Torah, you are producing for the world. You are producing. You are aiding the doctor. You are aiding the community. You are lifting and being mechazik the tzibur. Understand, regardless if you go out and teach it to the world, your learning Torah, Torah lishma, benefits the world. It's being productive. That's production. That was the hashkafa of Simcha Wasserman, which he was mekabel from Rav Elchanan Wasserman and clear from the Chafetz Chaim as well. You open up the Chafetz Chaim's Torah Sabayis, there's nothing that comes close to Torah learning. There's nothing that comes close to just pure, raw Torah learning, and that's it. So why did he go into Kirov? How did that happen? How did he get into outreach, which was one of his true loves in life? His father understood that his son, Rav Simcha Wasserman, has a very unique personality. He's not his father. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was very tough, very exacting, was a genius, was brilliant. For example, Rav Simcha Wasserman went away to a place where a treatment center when he was younger for an illness that he had. He walked back in the room, as the way Rav Simcha Wasserman tells it himself. He walked back in the room, and Rav Elchanan Wasserman turned to him, "How's my son doing?" He said, "I'm much better now." "Good. Let's get back to learning. You missed some time." You have to understand this is a very intense world. Rav Elchanan Wasserman knew that's not the world of Rav Simcha Wasserman. Rav Simcha Wasserman loves to schmooze, loves to have conversation, loves engaging with people and having dialogue with people. And he knew he had to turn his son in a direction where he could feel his kochos, his potential, his energies, his strengths to be tapped into the greatest. And it's Rav Elchanan, Rav Simcha said, who pushed him, his father, who pushed him in the direction of Kirov, in the direction of outreach. He loved teaching in his yeshiva the works, the writings of Rav Sajigon. He loved giving a shir on the Rambam. He gave a special shir on Hilchas Deos. And people in his shir knew that he quoted frequently the Chidah, loved the Chasam Sofer. His uncle, by the way, was no slouch. His uncle was the chief dayan of Vilna, the great Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski, one of the, probably not the greatest posik of the last 100 years. He spent time with him as well. And he also had a chance to meet on the Hasidic end. He also had a chance to meet the Rugachever, Rav Yosef Rosen, and he also had to meet the other, the one who lived, was very close to the Rugachever, the other sort of chief rabbi in Riga, who was Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, the great Meshe Chachma. The great Meshe Chachma. Rav Simcha Wasserman says his love for Kirov also came from his father's writing on the Ikvisa de Meshicha, on the end of time. What's going to happen as we draw near now, this era that's heading towards the end of time? Rav Simcha Wasserman saw, he noticed how those teachings attracted people with less background in learning, and he saw that could be a starting point by which to draw people. So you're talking about a gadol that's eventually going to get to Los Angeles, but we're not there yet. He establishes a kollel in 1942 in Manhattan. He founds the Eish Das Society in Spring Valley, which it was revamped and reinitiated, reignited 10 years ago. You can find it's now a blog, the Eish Das blog. It's an honor, it's a throwback to Rav Simcha Wasserman's creation in Spring Valley. He worked hard for the Vad Hatzala, which was instrumental at the end of the war in doing what it can to salvage whatever it can. 1943, he sets up a community in Detroit. He leaves in the middle. Why does he leave? We now have all the documentation to know why he left his community that he set up in Detroit. He left for a secret mission that we didn't know about till much later. Where did he go? He joined Chief Rabbi of Israel, Rav Herzog, to do what? Rav Herzog went on a mission to save Jewish children that were in monasteries after the war. That's where Rav Simcha Wasserman left Detroit. When Rav Simcha Wasserman heard that Rav Herzog is going to do this, Rav Herzog invited specifically Rav Simcha Wasserman, who knew the terrain, who knew the communities, who knew people in so many different areas, because he was, you understand the Hashgacha Pratis here, amazing Hashgacha Pratis, that his father needed someone to deliver his letters. He knows his son, like schmoozing, could talk and meet Gedolim and drink from their words, so he sent them all over. Rav Herzog, when he's thinking about how we're going to save these children in monasteries, I need somebody who knows all the turf. He was a guy from Scotland, Rav Herzog. He needs someone who knows these communities. Who's he going to turn to? What rabbinic figure knows so the lay of the land, so to speak? He turns to Rav Simcha Wasserman. And Rav Simcha Wasserman goes with him. We don't know the full extent of what they achieved and where they were able to go. 1952, he travels to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, sets up a community there as well. The Wassermans eventually are going to come to Los Angeles in the early 1950s. They're going to stay there until the end of the 1970s. They set out to accomplish... Was anybody here, by the way, in the yeshiva or got to meet Rav Simcha Wasserman here? Oh,
yeah.
We have.
Yeah.
All right, so now as I get into the yeshiva and I mention some of the stuff...
Not in the yeshiva, but in Los Angeles.
In the orbit.
Yeah.
Mr. Shulman, you were there? Okay, so now as we get into the heart of the subject, if there's anything that's mistaken or that needs to be added, please let me know, because this is a work in progress. I bought the pen.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was there in 54.
You were there 54. Do you remember his arrival?
I was there the second year he was here.
Okay.
He started in a house on Melrose.
Yes. Okay, good. So now, he set out to accomplish three goals when he was here. He wanted Torah schools for younger generations. That was set up in the valley. Torah, serious intensive Torah for younger kids, that he set up in the valley for the first 15 years. Number two, engage parents and families. Education at that time was working on the children. Hillel, we spoke about, Rabbi Gottesman was taking in anybody. It didn't matter if you didn't have two pennies to scratch together. Come, you need a place for your school. Rabbi Gottesman's work was not essentially thinking about being Makar of the families, although he had great relationships. His forte was forging great relationships with the parents. Rav Simcha Wasserman understood it's not just about educating the kids. Because what impacts the kids is the chinuch they're also getting at home. And that's going to affect the yeshiva. So you're going to need to work on both. You're going to need to work on classes for the adult. You know, it's like when I do conversions, it's often the one that needs the classes most is the husband, or the guy, the boyfriend, who's not converting. That's the one who's going to need most of the kirov classes. So Rav Simcha Wasserman understood he's going to be starting a yeshiva with certain values that are going to have tremendous dissonance with what's happening at home. And we're going to need to have an educational component for the parents as well. And Rav Simcha Wasserman wanted to work on an outreach idea. The concept of putting outreach shirim on tapes, Eish HaTorah says the first to do that was Rav Simcha Wasserman. They say he was the first one to actually think of passing tapes around in the Orthodox community and let people know about it. Now, tapes are, we're switching off the tapes, we're almost off done with the CDs, but there are still a few left in the counter in Pizza World and a couple other restaurants. Publications, manuals, people have sent me and emailed me photocopies of magazines, little three-page pamphlets that Rabbi Wasserman put out. We assume that we take it for granted. Adas Torah puts out a brilliant journal of Chidushei Torah from the entire shul, and it's assumed great, beautiful. But we take it for granted that was a huge deal. When Simcha Wasserman came here to put out even three pages was a big deal. Nobody was putting anything like that. It wasn't thought about in the Orthodox community. We were so far behind as far as thinking of shul programming. We were far behind in those areas. The early years in the valley did draw some of these gedolim. As we mentioned, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky was there in the early years. Some of his machers along the way, just to mention a couple names, as we said, we could trace, not only tracing the history of Gedolim or great rabbis here in Los Angeles, someone should do a series on the history of the Balabatim as well here in Los Angeles. Some of the names, a man by the name of Avram Abe Linderman, who was one of the main supporters of the yeshiva, and Mr. Beryl Weiss was one of the later supporters of the yeshiva, and there were many other great families who were involved in keeping Rav Simcha Wasserman's projects going. He believed very firmly that there should be no mixture with Torah. You don't mix Torah with anything else. Okay? If kids need another class here and this, fine. Don't mix and match. That's going to play a huge role when Rav Simcha Wasserman's ready to leave Los Angeles. You'll see how that that hashkafa is going to impact the future of Los Angeles in a very simple way. It originally was called West Coast Talmudical Seminary, was the original iteration of the yeshiva. And for a certain time, he would take in those who had difficulty, who were draft dodging, would be able to go to the yeshiva, like many of the yeshivas that opened up, makeshift yeshivas that opened up here to help people get out of going to Vietnam, to get out of the war.
Nobody called it anything but Wassermans.
What do you mean? The yeshiva. That was the name. You called it Wassermans. That was the name. You didn't call it the West Coast Talmudical Seminary. But Wassermans. Okay. The high school, most of the time.
Oh,
it is?
100%.
Okay. Yes. All right. We're going to get to how we got to Chabad. From our Wasserman to Chabad in a moment. For a certain time, he would take in, right, we said he would take in those that had difficulty with the law, we'll call it that, we'll leave it at that. For much of the time, the high school had a enrollment usually below 50. Usually below 50. There were a couple years in between where the number may have dipped slightly above, but the number was well below that for many of the years, certainly the later years. He wanted everyone to dorm at the yeshiva and eat the meals there. And he would eat with the kids. His wife would be there helping to prepare the meals and sit down with the children. They would serve as an av and aim bias to the children. You understand? This is why LA may not have fully appreciated at the time that there was a gadol here. Because he allowed himself to become close to the kids, to schmooze with them, to eat with them, to have meals with them. Not in the way a normal gadol usually carries himself. Another famous figure was a Rebbe in Rav Simcha Wasserman's yeshiva. You may know him. His name is Rabbi Yaakov Krauss from Young Israel of Hancock Park. We'll get to him momentarily, how he got to the yeshiva. He was there as well. When we talk about the history of the Hasidim in Los Angeles, we're going to be talking about who was the founder of Beis Yehuda or Magen Avram, the Shul. Who was it? Rav Isaacson? Rav Isaacson was brought in as a Magid Shir in the school as well. Rabbi Wasserman was trying to create partnerships and relationships. Many of them didn't go for different reasons, and that's because Rav Simcha Wasserman had a certain hashkafa for the school that he did not want altered and he did not want moved around, and that's the way it was going to be. He used to go up and around little towns around California, up the coast, looking for more Jews. Rav Simcha Wasserman, and you have to understand, this is a time, this is before Chabad is able to, you know, navigate the entire California for us, so us other Ashkenazim and Sephardim could sit back and let them do the work. Rav Simcha Wasserman said, nobody's doing this. He packed his bag, and he would go on trips looking for Jews around the coast of California. He used to smoke a pipe with tobacco, but he stopped. You know why he stopped? Amazing, Hashkafa. He said to himself, I have no taiva to smoke on Shabbos. I don't even have a slight impulse to smoke on Shabbos. Why not? Because it's usher. I can't. If I view smoking as I can't, then I won't. You understand? If I turn, it's an amazing idea, amazing insight. If you turn anything in your life as a must, not that I need to, not I need to or I want to. No, I must. If you turn your hashkafa into a must, you can accomplish anything. And that's where Wasserman taught his Talmidim. One mother came to Rav Wasserman and said, you're farfrumming our kids. My son flipped out. He won't eat in my house anymore. This was told to me by Dr. Fox. Dr. Fox said Rav Wasserman, Rav Wasserman said to the mother, I'm coming to your house tomorrow night for dinner. Rav Wasserman went to the house the next night, had a full dinner at the parents' house in front of the kid. Didn't say a word, but it schmoozed, whatever, left and went back home. He proceeded to eat dinner at their house. Amazing. Doesn't carry himself in the usual way. He took a bacher to eat in Yerushalayim. Now the bacher took him to a pizza shop, but once they walked into the pizza shop, the bacher realized this was lo lefik photo. I shouldn't have brought Rav Wasserman in a public area like this, a hustle bustle of a pizza shop. Rav Wasserman understood as well, that's not covetic for his position, to be eating, sitting there, stom eating in a pizza shop. It was a mess on multiple levels. Rav Wasserman asked for a soup. The man behind the counter, owner said, I'm sorry, I don't have any soup. They left. The student said, I'm sorry, Rebbe, for bringing you into the pizza shop. But why'd you ask, what was that about the soup? He said, if I would have walked out without asking for anything, the owner would have thought that I, the rabbi, don't think his place is kosher enough. So I looked at the wall and noticed what he doesn't have. He doesn't have soup. So I asked if he had soup. When he said he doesn't have soup, he thinks I'm leaving because I'm just looking for a soup somewhere. Nothing to do with his hashgacha. What? You understand that's five steps removed. You have to think ahead of time. That's the way a Baal Midas. That's Nevordak. That's that you got in the Nevordak yeshiva. You're trained to think in that way. The yeshiva didn't always, not every student was necessarily going to be the Gon Olam that came into the yeshiva. There were many great Mitzuyanim in the yeshiva, but there were many who were not. And on one occasion on a Shabbos, Suda Shlishit, they were singing around the table. One of the visitors that was there, one of the Bachrim that were coming to look at the yeshiva, turns, didn't know much about yeshivish life, turns and says, "Oh, this niggin reminds me of Old Man River." All the Talmidim look around aghast, knowing that Rav Simcha Wasserman knows from Old Man. What are you mentioning, Old Man River? The guy was about to be completely embarrassed as they were about to shush him. Rav Wasserman silenced everybody else, and he said to the student, he said, "Please, how does Old Man River go? Could you sing it at Suda Shlishi?" And the boy began to teach them the Old Man River Niggin, that Shalashiris, teach the Niggin. The Rebbetzin was also a bar hachi, so to speak, someone who was a bar yeda, someone who knew, who was holding. Supposedly, she knew Tanakh inside and out, backwards and forwards. Here's another story that came to me from Dr. David Fox. Dr. Fox said one time he was waiting to see Rav Wasserman with a shaila that he had, a contradiction in the Mishnah Berurah. Rav Wasserman was busy in a meeting. The wait was very long. So she said, let me see what you have. And he gave her the sefer, and he pointed out the stira. He said, "I'll humor her while I'm waiting for a Wasserman." She looked at him and said, "The stira is only a stira because you don't realize that Chet Aleph stands for Chaye Adam. It stands for Chaye Adam, and because of that, you have the abbreviation all wrong, and now there's no stira in the Mishnah Berurah." She solved the stira in the Mishnah Berurah that he was about to ask Rav Simcha Wasserman. She would always arrange accommodations for those in the community, anybody who needed a meal. Think about the hospitality of the Wassermans. Somebody kept... There's a minigin yeshivas to raid the cholent Shabbos night. That is, the cholent's waiting to be eaten Shabbos day at the Kiddush. Bachrim often find a way to get into the kitchen. And it's one of those minhagim, the stealing that's allowed. Like on Simchas Torah, we permit some form of a vandal at some level. This was allowed to. You jump, you go into the kitchen, and you chop some of the cholent, raiding the cholent. Now, Rabbi Wasserman had a dilemma. It's a Hilcha Shabbos dilemma. Pulling out some of the chulent, if they didn't remove it properly, or if they didn't take it out properly, maybe it was a problem of magus, maybe they caused the rest of the chulent to heat up too quickly by removing some of the chulent. So he had an idea. So not to embarrass the Bachrim, who wanted to go on the Friday night raids, the Shabbos night raids, Rabbi Wasserman instituted that there should be a minhag now of a second Shabbos morning chulent. No one touches, we're having a Shabbos night chulent and a Shabbos day chulent. Once that became the norm, they also instituted that Shalashuddah should have the third chulent, so no one should waste any of the chulent that was there in the first two pots, O yeshiva. Rav Holland, who is here in Los Angeles, came also as a director for the yeshiva. Somebody drove Rav Moshe Feinstein back after he came to visit Los Angeles. What year was that? Remember when Moshe Feinstein came to Los Angeles? There's a picture of it. I saw a picture of it. What do we have? All right, we're going to look into that. We have to find out where he spoke and what he said. If anybody can get that information, that would be great. If we have any notes or anything from whatever he came to do or lecture about while he was here at Moshe, that would be good history. So in the car on the way back, I spoke to the person who gave Rav Moshe Feinstein a ride on the way back. And the person said that Rav Moshe Feinstein said to them, "Wow, Rav Wasserman knows his shas backwards and forwards." You understand? When Rav Moshe Feinstein says that about somebody else, now you understand what you had in Los Angeles. Now we understand what our community had here for a period of time. This was an amazing individual. There was a janitor in the yeshiva for some time, an African-American. His name was Harry. Does that make sense? His name was Harry. Some of the yeshiva boys were misbehaving. So Harry said the following: "These kids must be some bad seeds." Why? Rav Wasserman said, "How do you know those few kids who are misbehaving must be bad seeds?" He says, "Because there ain't no way they're going to be looking at the roach and still acting this way." Who's the roach? The roach is the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh. There ain't no way they could be staring at the Rosh Yeshiva of this godless, of this greatness, and still act away. So Harry weighed in and said, those couple kids you took in, those are bad seeds. Rav Wasserman closed the yeshiva in 1977. He sold to Chabad. Why did he sell to Chabad? And as Fishman pointed out, that you could see the yeshiva today. Where is it? In the corner of what and what? Willoughby. Willoughby and Waring.
Waring.
King's Road. Dorton, Altavista. It's on 7, but his parents must be a big building then. 8 block. So the yeshiva, Waring. The yeshiva, Waring. Okay, the yeshiva is, so I don't forget, by the way, we're not doing the Chabad of Sola Shir, where we're going to do the history of Chabad in 2 Monday nights from now, because the Cheder Menachem dinners that night. It's like doing the Rav Simcha Wasserman Shir the night that the Wasserman's yeshiva dinner would be. So it's not, we'll postpone, we'll pick a different date, we'll figure it out. But let's get back to, now, the yeshiva, listen to this. Wasserman's yeshiva is on the corner of Kings Road, Waring, Alta Vista, Pointe de, it's on that corner. The yeshiva was never there when Rav Wasserman was there. They never had a yeshiva on that corner. So what does it mean Wasserman's yeshiva is there? What does that mean? It's the most fascinating story. When Rav Simcha Wasserman wanted to move to Israel and start a yeshiva there, when he saw that the project here in Los Angeles was running its course. And by the way, why didn't the yeshiva work fully? Why didn't it become just the place to be where everybody went to? There are a couple theories as to why. Number one, if you were from an intensive yeshiva frumer family, and there weren't many of those in L.A., but you wanted an intensive yeshiva education, so you sent to the classic yeshivas. You sent your kids back east to the classic yeshivas that were reminiscent of the yeshivas that you remember from the Altaheim. If you were what you were called a modern Jew, so to speak. We saw the term modern Orthodox already appeared in an article from 1908, it was, right? If you were a regular modern Jew here in Los Angeles, you wanted a stronger academic experience that was being offered at Rav Wasserman's yeshiva. Some want to say that the Hasidim who were here in Los Angeles at the time, they or the Hungarians, so to speak, they were of a different ilk than Rav Wasserman, so they didn't push their kids in that direction, even the ones who were here. And much of that will lead to the development and the history of Torah Semis, which I don't know how much we'll get to tonight, but I just want to lay the bricks, so to speak, for that. By the way, that's why Rav Wasserman was aware of this, and he specifically hired Rav Isaacson, who was one of the main builders of Torah Semis, founded Torah Semis, to teach in his yeshiva, because he knew there was this dissonance between their communities. So he's going to leave Los Angeles. The Gadol is about to pack up, and Los Angeles is going to lose its super Gadol in 1970. By the way, thank you so much. Harry Green passed me a beautiful picture of Wasserman right before the shir. What a face and a wonderful smile, which on the cover, there's some of his Divrei Torah you can buy from. It's no longer in print. I got it on eBay. Rav Simcha Speaks, which are teachings from Rav Simcha Wasserman, written down by Rabbi Akiva Tatz, who I saw is coming to LA. Now, why did he sell to Chabad? What does one have to do with the other? He had three options in front of him. One, Chafetz Chaim wanted to establish a home in Los Angeles. Not the Chafetz Chaim, the Chafetz Chaim yeshiva, the Chafetz Chaim, the family's yeshiva. But the rumor has it that while his father was a student of the Chafetz Chaim, the family was a student of the Chafetz Chaim in the hashkafic sense, in their worldview, not in their derech halimud, not in the style of learning. And therefore, he didn't want to see his yeshiva adopt the practice of the Chafetz Chaim, derech halimud. Eventually, the Chafetz Chaim project would make it out to L.A. Who knows what its first iteration would be called? Valley Torah. Valley Torah would be the outpost for Chafetz Chaim on the West Coast. And it's still, in many ways, it still is that way today.
Feeder.
What?
It's a feeder.
It's a feeder. By the way, you need if we're going to do a 1970, if we're going to do a Valley series, which I only did a few minutes, Shari Tzedek, but the important year you need is 1978, 1979 for the Valley. Everything changed in the Valley in those years. And this was related to that as well. Next option was Yeshiva University wanted to put something here, and there were many attempts, which I'll mention in another shir. Rav Wasserman didn't want that either because he believed Lishma was only with Torah. Why use philosophy, mixed Torah, and academics that you could use one to understand the other? As Rav Aaron Lichtenstein himself once said, I heard it with his own mouth, you can't understand Mishlei without reading Paradise Lost. For Rav Wasserman, that was a no-no. There's no way you could even have that in the same breath. And Rav Wasserman said the following idea. that the Gemara says that Avram davened exactly at noon. So why do we daven around half hour later? Because we are not experts in astronomy. Says Rav Wasserman, but the Gemara of Avodah Zarah says that Avram learned all day. How was he an expert in astronomy? Says Rav Simcha Wasserman, what you see is, if you learn enough Torah, everything is in the Torah. You could learn everything you need in the world. The Torah is not lacking anything that you need anything else besides Torah. Torah has everything. Oh, what was his position on college and university and kids getting other a secular education? Rav Simcha Wasserman's philosophy was that, yes, we have an obligation based on the Mishnah and Kedushin to teach our kids a livelihood so they could survive. So he says, you need to know. Any classes you're going to take, you have to take it. If you got to take a chemistry class, he said, my father, Rav Chana Wasserman, said you could do such a thing. But it's got to be not lishma. Meaning Torah's got to be lishma, but don't take it lishma. Meaning you're not going for the geshmak of the chemistry. You're going because chemistry is going to help you with the job that you need, specific job that you need. Rav Simcha Wasserman said, and if it's a college that necessitates teaching evolution, then it's usher for you to go. But you can take a class. And he also said another statement. He said, once you're already taking a class because you need to take the class, it's usher for a Jew to say, let me just pass. He says, that's Bittelsman. Once you're already taking the class, you get the A in that class. You master that class, Rav Simcha Wasserman said. So two options didn't work for Rav Simcha Wasserman. Then there was Chabad. Now, Chabad's Hashkafa is, in a way, there is alignment in the outreach sense. There is alignment. But he had a soft spot for Chabad. And why is that? We have correspondences between the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Simcha Wasserman, for one. They corresponded. Number two, one of his close friends from back home, from his childhood, a major Talmud Chacham, was involved in the Chabad community. And they had always kept in touch. They had remained friends. And specifically, the outreach component, the Chabad, spoke to him. The deal was going to be, but the yeshiva has to keep the name. And it's to this day, it's called Or Elchanan, as in Rav Elchanan Wasserman, in honor of his father. He named the yeshiva officially after his father, not himself, after his father. They agreed to keep the name. 3 years later, after, you know, crossing over and becoming Or Elchanan, a Chabad yeshiva, 3 years later, they take the building, that base medrash, they put it on a truck, and they move it up to its current location. So in a sense, it is still Wasserman's yeshiva, because it's the same building. But it never was on that spot. In a sense, it's a good trivia question, you guys. What yeshiva in Los Angeles is the same building, but it never was there? Right? I think you're crazy. I think you're nuts. But that's the answer. Wasserman's yeshiva. It was never there, but it's the same building. It moves. The building stands as it was before, just in a different location. The original property was sold by Rav Kunin. Rav Kunin sold the original areas. I think it was sold to become condominiums and the money used for Chabad's enterprise, which we're going to get to when we have that makeup date. That's the story of Rav Simcha Wasserman. You could look at it and say, well, he came and it didn't work. But you could look at this a totally different way and understand that Rav Simcha Wasserman came, had a hashpa, and from him and because of him, LA was changed because numerous individuals made their way through the door of the yeshiva and would go have an impact on the yeshiva. I want to tell one or two of those stories. Where do we see that happening? One of the figures that was by the kollel of Rav Wasserman was Sender Mendelovitz. Sender Mendelovitz was very active in the Jewish community, in the national Jewish scene. And he had passed word that there was an opening for a 10th grade Rebbe. They were looking for a 10th grade Rebbe. A young man in Kollel in Muncie by the name of Rav Yaakov Kraus goes to ask his Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, should I go, right? He wants to go get advice from his Rebbe. Should I go to Los Angeles or take some of the East Coast offers that I was, jobs that I was being offered? Rebbitzin Kraus says, don't mention the LA option. No one wants to go to LA. There's nothing there. We don't want to go to LA. Don't mention LA. Just mention the Brooklyn and the Far Rockaway options. Leave off LA. Rav Yaakov Kraus goes to the Rosh Yeshiva, to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and he tells him Far Rockaway and he tells him Brooklyn. And the Rav Kamenetsky looks at him and says, Vusnach, there must be something else. And at that point, he says, I couldn't lie. To leave something out, omission is fine. But to lie to Rav Yaakov, I couldn't do. So he turns and he says, Los Angeles. Rav Yaakov says, now you're talking. Go for 2 years, see how you like it, head out there. and fascinating. From an opening of a 10th grade Rebbe in Rav Simcha Wasserman's yeshiva, you have Rav Yaakov Krauss, who has such a large impact in the Torah Semis community, Young Israel of Hancock Park, and he moves out there. And it's going to be Rabbi Krauss who brings Rabbi Teichman to become the principal eventually, who's going to be with him in Rav Wasserman's yeshiva, and then come with him to be a principal, to be a assistant principal at Torah Semis, and is going to leave eventually to start Kehila Kashrus, to fix, to deal with some of the Kashrus issues here in Los Angeles. We're going to get to that chapter. That's the last chapter, the story of Kashrus here in LA. We're gonna look into that. And he's going to start Kehila Kashrus with Richie Schuster and some other individuals. Who was the principal, the dean, for part of the time while Rabbi Krauss is there at Torah Semis? The dean is going to be Rabbi Lowe. I'm going to cover his story in the story of Chassidus here in LA. I think the next one is at Mogen Avram next week. That's going to be when I cover the Chassidic story of Los Angeles. Mogen David, not Mogen Avram. Mogen David, right. Mogen Avram no longer exists. Came Beis Yehuda. Nixed that from the recording. All right. Young Israel of Hancock Park is started in 1976. It started by a bunch of people who move away from one of the shuls that is really the center at the time, and that's the Young Israel of Los Angeles. What's the Young Israel of Los Angeles? Who knows what street that's on?
Melrose.
Spalding and Melrose. There we got it right. Spalding and Melrose. That's the Young Israel. That's where Rabbi Grumman's going to spend time. Rabbi Bloom. Many great figures who are all stars here in Los Angeles are going to spend time at that shul. Are going to spend time over there. We'll talk about that in my makeup one for Yavna, the history of that shul. That's going to be the Young Israel of Hancock Park. It's going to start a breakaway because people are moving away from Melrose. The Jewish community is developing in the other direction away from Melrose, closer to 2nd, closer to 1st, away from the Oakwoods and the Clintons. Now, the original location for the Young Israel of the Young Israel of Hancock Park, which was founded initially, some of the main founders at the beginning was Leo Eschweger, Richie Schuster, Lou Schoen. The first minion was in Lou Schoen's home. It was originally a liquor store on La Brea and First. When the new post office is built on Beverly Boulevard, they then purchased that building. Somebody named Marty Mayerfield is gonna purchase that building. It was officially a branch of the Young Israel of Los Angeles, and Rabbi Grumman asked people to rotate back and forth. Young married people would come in and give shirim. Lakewood Kollel, which we're going to get to the story of the Lakewood invasion, that's how we're going to get to how we get to the Rabbi Revach side story. We're going to get to, we have a whole section on you, Rabbi Revach, have to make sure to tape it. That they come in 1975, they're going to give shirim at the Young Israel of Hancock Park. And just to understand, the biggest Rabbonim in the 70s here in L.A., you're talking about a Rav Halberstam was here, whose son lives on Martel, and you have, it's not officially Martel, right? Fuller. Grew up my whole life there. Rav Isaacson, and Rav Isaacson, whose story is an amazing story. You hear his story, unbelievable, and Rav Wasserman. Those were really the 70s, had three formidable figures here in the rabbinate in Los Angeles, really amazing figures. I want to close with a little bit of the story of Torah Semis. Torah Semis was started with the premise, and you should understand that it was started that it was not going to be founded by Rav Asher Zilberstein. Rav Asher Zilberstein was, in a sense, was very frum, exceptionally frum, a big, massive Talmud Chacham, but he had a modern worldview, I would say, or perhaps a modern Orthodox worldview. The founders of the Torah Semis said, we need something different. We want a different school that should be available for our children here in L.A. Should be available here in L.A. There's a machlokas when Torah Semis first exists. Some are of the opinion that it existed in 1951. The rove, the majority, or those who were the ones with their insight, say it didn't really exist to 1955. How do you forget 4 years? How do we miss? It's not like we're talking about the times of the Beis Hamikdash. We don't know. We lost with the Yovel. It's right now. This is right. What do you mean? Just look back at the banquet journals. Why can't we figure out? The answer to questions like that when they come up here in the history of LA is basically because institutions go through a few additions, so to speak. For example, across from Rabbi Halberstam Shul on 3rd, there's another shul and a day school. There's a day school there. Someone by the name of Rabbi Martin owns the building and rents it to a young chevra. That's, according to some, the first Torah Semis. According to others, that had nothing to do with Torah Semis. Rabbi Isaacson is going to take a leadership role in some of the years we move forward deeper into the 50s. Car wash takes over. You have a car wash in the area as well. They take over that place, which is supposedly Torah Semes. So there's a Talmud Torah that's open and floundering in Boyle Heights. In Boyle, nobody is using it at all. Torah Semes says, let's bus the kids over into Boyle Heights. Now, Boyle Heights is falling apart at this point. The heyday is beginning to wane. Some of the teachers there might be names that you remember. Rav Chamenetsky is there, is a Rebbe in that era over there. Some of you may have had him as a teacher here in Los Angeles, the Malamed. Rabbi Tesler was a Rebbe there as well. He gave my first pair of tefillin, Rabbi Tesler. See, he was a Rebbe here in Los Angeles. Who were these Rebbeim? Who were the Rebbeim at the time? The Rebbeim were survivors. What that means is that we don't appreciate who the Rebbeim are now in our schools. The Rebbeim in our schools now, by and large, are people who have been trained in chinuch, who have been trained in education, who have had people who are expert observing them, critiquing them, giving them advice, giving them hadracha. These are people who went into the job because they have a love for working with children. Often, many of the yeshivas here in LA, there wasn't a plethora of people. And often, people who were hired for a time being in these yeshivas, often many of the people were people who never should have gone into chinuch in a million years, never should have been near teaching children. And a large generation of Jewish kids are gone forever. They have terrible memories when they talk about some of their years. Many people who are here who made it have either two memories. One, they remember the crazy stuff, but they loved it anyways. They'll say, get over it. We all went through it. Move on. Other people said we can never move on from that stuff. It was a very difficult time. This was a time for survivors. It was, as they say, you know, Hitler made the shidduch. Hitler picked the mechanchim, so to speak. Aligning who was going to teach in many of the yeshivas. And for that, the yeshiva struggled for many years to really have a major positive impact. And that's why we have to go back to the story. I'm not going to repeat the story again, but to really note the significance of Rav Zalman Uri. Rav Uri, who was here in Los Angeles, made it his business to work on these mechanchim because they had no training. He made it his job to meet with them one-on-one, to give them advice as best as possible to help them become effective educators. And Rav Uri's legacy is not celebrated enough here in Los Angeles. And you can read plenty about him, how great he was, his correspondences. You have to see the two-volume saver. I think it's called Kedushas Avram. You got to see the two volumes. There's unbelievable correspondence in education, stuff that bothered him about chinuch here in Los Angeles. He was crying for the children here in Los Angeles, what they had to go through. After a year in Boyle Heights, Rav Gansweig's shul in the back, I guess we are a Gansweig also, Rav Gansweig's shul in the back has a space. That's also supposedly considered Torah Semes, according to some. Rav Amram Blum was the Rebbe there. Those who were in Torah Semes in those years say he was the best Rebbe in Los Angeles at the time. The best Rebbe in Los Angeles. People say it was their best years. He was also the rabbi of the Young Israel of Melrose, and part of Torah Semes had classes in the Young Israel of Melrose. Rav Blum was a major Talmud Chacham. Add him to our list of huge Talmud Chachamim who's here. He left. He would go to South America. He went to South America. He first was South America, then he came here. Actually, he was first in South America. He was actually close to Juan Perón. And there are stories. You can find numerous stories of him and his relationship with Juan Perón. His family, his daughter Hadassah, marries perhaps one of the biggest Rosh Yeshiva in the country right now, Rav Nosson Vachtfogel. Torah Semes. To close with one more story. I want to move ahead to when it was on Fairfax. It spent a time on Fairfax. In 1978, it's a small school. It's not like Yavna, and it's not like Beth Jacob, like Hillel. Everybody complained, we need a better school. We need a better school. So at that time, you have some younger families who begin to get involved in trying to shift and build Torah Semes. One, for example, you may know Emil Fish. Emil Fish got involved at the time as well to try to make a difference at Torah Semes. Rav Isaacson was now in his full koach, and as much koach as he had, was in full strength. So some of the younger Balabatim went to Rav Isaacson and said, how is it that we have beautiful homes here? Jews are now finally beginning to come into some wealth, and they're living tremendously, but we have a junk school. We have a little nothing school. So Rav Isaacson said, you have my blessing. Let's go look for a property. On Fairfax and 6th Street, there was a building called Carl's Shoes. The building is empty. People start getting involved. The Ziskin, you know, Moshe Ziskin is also a young family at the time. The Ziskin family gets involved. What's wrong with Carl's Shoes? Why didn't Torah Semis move there? Carl's Shoes had a wooden roof, which means any building with a wooden roof is illegal for a school. They find the lot on La Brea. Some of these young families go to Rav Isaacson and said, this is a nice, this is a chashuv amount of space. He says, if you want to organize it, go for it. The old guard, so to speak, was opposed to it. They were more traditional, conservative. You don't just commit yourself to all this space before you have all the children and all the money to pay for all this property. They put their foot down. The younger families in Torah Semis, which would really change the direction of Torah Semis, bringing in Rabbi Krauss because they were aligned with him already at Torah Semis. So you have that union, which would again, that's how Rasim Chawasserman impacts LA again, and affects it in a sense. So Rav Isaacson said to the younger families, you have the green light. And it angered some of the older families that were in Torah Semis that had given money to the cause and said they're throwing away money, throwing away money. It was found later on that one of the main opponents to building the property over there was against it because he had put a bid on the property to build a retirement home there. That was one of the reasons he was opposed to it. The younger families caught wind of it and they pushed forward with this plan. And now you look at Torah Semis, what it's become now. I think the enrollment is somewhere upwards of 1,500 children. It's a massive campus, a boys and girls campus. It's become really one of the preeminent yeshivish schools in the country, if not in the top three yeshivish schools in the country in every sense of the word. And therefore, its inception, its development was in many ways impacted by many of the stories we're sharing today. But we have much more to go. Torah Semis is not going to become Torah Semis till that group arrives from Lakewood, which we're going to get to, God willing, in a few weeks. We'll stop there for today.
Very nice. Go ahead. Very nice. Amazing.
Okay, good.
The Rebbe's were trained by